We're still continuing our discussion of food. Since you've been away, we've talked about food.
Oh, is that it?
Kosher food, different laws of what makes it kosher and non-kosher. So before we go forward this week, I wanted just to review one idea from last week, because I think we rushed through a very deep idea quickly last week at the end, and I just wanted to maybe go over that idea one more time. We were discussing the idea of the kosher grasshopper, or the kosher locust, and the kosher fish, right? Kosher fish is covered in scales, and the kosher locust has its wings covering its entire body. So we had discussed kind of a Kabbalistic idea, the idea of clothing, how the scales on a fish or the wings covering the locust, which are the kosher locust has wings covering its whole body, and the kosher fish has to have scales. That's actually representative of clothing. And the idea of clothing, according to Kabbalistic sources, is a very powerful idea. So we talked about it last week. I felt I rushed through it a little bit. I just wanted to go back just for a few minutes and discuss that one more time. We find in the Garden of Eden, so the snake is described as being Arum. So usually it was translated as clever, which is one translation of the word Arum. But the other translation is that he was naked, he was unclothed. Adam and Eve, even though they were unclothed, the Torah does record that God was intending to give them clothing, the way that the rabbis describe it, even prior to their sin. Their kind of clothing. It would have been kind of a translucent type of material. It's a very interesting discussion of what clothing they would have had prior to their sin. After their sin, they had to wear normal clothing. But it's a whole discussion as to what that clothing meant, why they needed the clothing, etc. But we see that the snake is described, the snake who is the epitome of evil, and the epitome of bringing the sheker, falsehood, into the world, lies into the world. So he is described as Arum, which could be rendered as being naked. So we see that things which are of the realm of evil can be described as naked, and those things which are of the realm of purity and good are described as clothed. So just understand that, again, quickly in two ways. Number one, clothing always represents that there's something here more than meets the eye, meaning that if a person walked around without clothes on, so you take a person as a physical body, but we express ourselves through our clothing. I'm not just a body, I'm much deeper than that. I have a soul, I have a brain, I have emotions, and I express myself in that way. So don't just look at my body, look at me as a person who goes beyond my body. And we express ourselves through clothing. What we wear expresses who we are. It expresses the event we're going to, it might express, you know, our job, it might express how we want to present ourselves to the world. That's expressed through clothing. So clothing is a basic layer of expression of a person, which shows that I'm not just, you know, a bunch of meat, I actually have a lot more to me. That's how we look at clothing on a very, you know, very basic level. On a deeper level, the terminology of clothing is used over and over and over again in deeper works, Hasidic works, Kabbalistic works, to describe how there are some things out there which cannot be understood in this world directly. Meaning that the things of the soul, of the spirit, they're not physical, they're spiritual, they're abstract, and we live in a physical world, we have physical brains, you know, we deal with the physical realities, and we can't necessarily understand things which are way beyond us. So for instance, the body is described as the clothing of the soul. Because the soul in this world can't function on its own right, it can't interact with the physical. The body is the clothing on top of the soul, which allows it to now be accessed and interact with this world. So that's described as being clothing. There's some ideals. You can think of an ideal of, any ideal in life. Let's talk about justice. So justice is an abstract concept, and doesn't have much meaning as an abstract concept. But once we see examples of justice, now we understand what justice means, and that's called the clothing of justice. Now justice has expressed itself through this event, through that event, through this decision, through that decision. So now justice is through its clothing, through its outer layer, which we see it actually put into play. We can now understand justice. So that's the idea of clothing on a much deeper level. It's used a lot throughout Kabbalistic works. This idea of concepts and ideals and spiritual things being clothed so you can actually understand and access them in this world. When it comes to the forces of divine, of spirituality, of good, so those are all forces which need clothing on them, because you can't necessarily understand God, you can't understand God directly, you can't understand the soul directly, but through physical actions and events and objects, that's how we understand God. So you have concepts of spirituality which are expressed through the Shabbos candles. So it's a very physical object that expresses a very deep spiritual ideal. So that's the clothing upon that spiritual ideal. You have a spiritual ideal expressed through tefillin. can have a spiritual ideal expressed through a lulav. You have lots of, those are all considered clothing upon these spiritual ideas, because those ideas might be like the floaty, abstract ideas. Once you clothe it in a physical object, and you access it through that way, you can understand the deeper elements behind it all. So it's a deep concept, it's a very, very abstract concept, but that's how clothing is always described in many ways, in many deeper, you know, Torah works. So when it comes to, as we said, we can't fully understand what makes an animal kosher or not kosher. But the way that some of these Kabbalistic sources describe it is that a kosher fish has what we would look at as clothing, has scales. Scales are the clothing on the fish. Because those things which are of the world of good and of the divine, of spirituality, need to be clothed. However, things which are of the world of, let's call it, the world of evil, the world of the impure. So those concepts are not, those are all limited to our world. In the ultimate spiritual realm, there's no evil. It's all good, it's all God, everything is spiritual. Anything which we view as evil or impure is only of our physical world. So those things can be accessed directly. We don't need to have clothing. The snake doesn't have clothing on, because the snake is a representative of evil. And things that represent evil don't need to be clothed, because that's all of our world. That's how I understand it. The second point made was that the kosher fish and grasshopper, locust, I keep saying grasshopper, it's really a locust, I think they describe it as. The kosher locust, not the difference between the two, but it's a locust. And the kosher locust has the extra legs it hops on, keeps it off the ground, keeps it up in the air, and the kosher fish has to have fins. So we also described last week how things which are false are described as having no legs, because things that are false don't stand. They're not eternal, they're temporary, they eventually come collapsing down on their foundations, because they have no foundation. So we described how in the Hebrew alphabet, the word for falsehood in Hebrew is sheker, shin, kuf, resh, and each of those letters only stands on one point, because it has no firm foundation. If you look at the letters shin, kuf, resh, all of them have one leg. If you think about the letters for truth in Hebrew, emes, aleph, mem, and tuf, each has two legs, because truth has a firm foundation and remains, and falsehood has a shaky foundation and will collapse. So therefore, the kosher fish has its fins as they keep it up and afloat, because it comes from the world of truth and purity. The kosher locust has extra legs, has to hop on, that keeps it, you know, high in the air, floating, and gives it a firm balance on the ground, because they come from the world of truth and purity, whereas non-kosher locusts or fish don't have the fins or the extra legs, which mean that they somehow have their roots in a more impure world. So that's the idea I think we rushed through last week. I just wanted to go over it one more time, because I think we rushed through it a little bit too fast. And even now, it's a deep idea, and I'm sure everyone has to kind of, you know, process it a little bit.
Rabbi,
yes?
The snake has scales.
That's a very good point. I don't know if this qualifies halachic scales. We talked about last week, a halachic scale has to be one that peels off easily with the fingernail. Some fish have scales, but they don't peel off. Those aren't called scales in Torah law. A scale means it peels off very easily when you rub on it. I don't think a snake's scales would peel off if you rub on the snake, to my knowledge. I don't know. But
it's not a fish.
Interesting point.
Yeah. But it frees air.
It's true, but you're just saying in terms of clothing.
Clothing.
The snake has its clothing also. I mean, also we see, I think someone mentioned last week, how the snake lost its legs after the sin. It used to have legs. And once the snake sinned and lied and created this falsehood in the world, the snake lost its legs. Because now the snake is totally in the world of falsehood and sheker and lies, and therefore it's lost that firm foundation it used to have by having legs. So that's the very deep and fascinating idea.
Does that relate to sneas?
So certainly.
Spiritual meaning to sneas?
Absolutely, because sneas is showing that I'm much more than my physical body. You know, the fact that I cover myself in clothing means I'm not just a physical piece of meat. I'm not just like an animal walks around unclothed. I'm a human being who covers themselves, because we know that we're much deeper than our flesh. You know, but if you're looking at me, you're not seeing just flesh and skin. There's a much deeper person there. So the clothes cover up the skin, so you look at the person on a deeper level. That's the idea of sneas.
Is there sneas rule of laws for men?
Certainly, yeah, certainly. It's become that, you know, the focus has become so much on telling women what is that, how long their sleeve should be and how long their skirt should be, etc. But sneas applies to every single person, because it means that I'm going to walk around in a way which is modest, in a way which shows that I don't want to show you that I'm just a physical body. I want to show you that I'm a human being with much deeper parts of me than my physical body. I don't want to draw people's attention based on how I look and how I dress. The modesty is a concept which goes across the board. So, for some reason, it's become, the focus has become on women, But it definitely applies to men as well, and just as much. So that's the concept. That's this deep concept when it comes to the kosher fish and the kosher locust. Now, one other thing I want to do
with kosher locusts, I'd like to step back to that real quick. Are you saying, in essence, that they're edible, or you're just saying?
Yeah, they're edible. We talked about it last week, but there are people nowadays who actually eat locusts. I mean, in Africa, it's not an uncommon food.
Grasshoppers and other things, you know, over time. But
right.
You're saying that in essence.
I actually read an account. I mentioned it last week. I think of a nation in Africa. And whenever they have like a locust infestation, they're very excited, a swarm, they're very excited because that's their food. They catch them out of the air and they pickle them and they keep them. They eat the locusts, yeah. So some species are actually kosher. I mean, we don't necessarily have a tradition as to which species. So most Jews will not, even if they wanted to, would avoid locusts. But they are technically, there are kosher locusts out there. Well, so one other thing I wanted to do with kosher species is we didn't get to discussing the specific species of birds that are kosher or not kosher. We did mention last week how the Torah lists specifically which birds are not kosher, which implies to us every other species of bird in the world is kosher. We did mention last week also that you have to have a tradition as to which species are the ones the Torah mentions, because sometimes translations, you know, after 2,000 years can be lost and distorted. So therefore, our custom is only the birds that we have a tradition that are kosher. But according to the basic Torah law, the list in the Torah are the only non-kosher birds that exist, and all of their birds should be kosher. So in terms of just the meaning behind this, just some symbolism behind these non-kosher birds. And again, these are all, we call them chukim last week. We can't fully understand what makes it kosher or non-kosher. These are laws which the human mind doesn't necessarily comprehend. But there are some hints in the names of all the non-kosher birds to concepts that are negative or evil or bad traits which one should acquire, and therefore we avoid eating these birds. So I found in a sefer, it's called Sifsei Kohen. It's also a kind of a deeper Kabbalistic type work. And he discusses the names of the non-kosher birds, what each name symbolizes. And again, we always go back to that the original introduction to kosher and non-kosher foods, which is that when you eat any type of food, it has an effect on who you are. It has an effect on your body, effect on your soul, and effect on your emotions, because you are what you eat in all levels. So therefore, if these birds represent things which are evil, are inappropriate, by eating them, it somehow will affect you in that way. So, and again, this list is by no means the only reason why these birds should be non-kosher, but just we see that there are allusions in the names of the non-kosher birds to bad mitos and bad ideals and bad traits and bad drives in this world. So let's just go through the list and we'll talk about each one individually. So the first non-kosher bird mentioned in Hebrew is a nesher. Typical translation is eagle. And again, I'll give you the translations which are the typical mainstream translations. I found these all in the Living Torah by Rabbi Ari Kaplan, who's a very reliable source for translations. However, again, if we don't have a tradition, then we don't eat any bird without a tradition for it, because you can never 100% be sure this is the right translation. But typically, nesher is translated as an eagle. The word nesher in Hebrew also refers to fruits that fell off a tree. Fruits which are called, the word nosher means to fall off of something. There's a halakha concept discussed about pirus hanoshrim, fruits which fell off a tree on their own, and they're not such high-quality fruits. What kind of blessing do they get on those fruits? That's a discussion in the Gemara. But the word nesher refers to falling off of something. So the Sifsei Kohen, this work which I was looking at discussing the symbolism behind the names of the birds, he says that falling off of the tree is representative of a person who is casting off mitzvos, casting off the belief of God from their heart. Because we look at a person is firmly rooted. It's described many times that a tzaddik, a righteous person, is like a tree who has firm roots in the ground. We look at God in this world. You know, God is the tree which kind of supports this world. The tree provides fruit for us. The tree provides us a strong foundation and roots. Somebody, it's actually a modern Hebrew term. Those Jews who reject Judaism are called noshrim, I think is the word in modern Hebrew, even. It's the same roots, nesher, noshrim. They fell off the path. So he says that the idea of nesher has to do with one casting off mitzvahs and casting off belief in God from their heart. The second bird mentioned is a peres, I believe. Let me just make sure I'm pronouncing it right. I don't have the vowels in front of me. Let me make sure I pronounce the names accurately.
There's a taxi company in Israel.
Called what?
Nesher,
yeah. Well, because of the eagle.
It's swift.
Swift like an eagle.
What I want to ask you is, this seems somewhat subjective. If you took the word nesher, you could probably find characteristic or an adjective that was a positive, that had a positive trait to it. So this kind of kind of parsing, and to try to look for a negative kind of word seems kind of rather
suspicious to me. You're right, but there's two things to look at. Number one, the fact that the Torah lists these as the non-kosher birds, I mean, there is some negative connotation to the bird itself.
Yeah, but why do you have to come up with some kind of word that has that? I mean, why don't you just accept it? It's not kosher.
Well, we were looking for some deeper meaning behind it. And these are works which are based off Kabbalistic sources, which do have
deeper meaning
to it. Yeah, it's, when God says a bird's not kosher, it's not random. There is some deeper meaning to it. So as I said, this is not necessarily the meaning why it equals not kosher. But you see, even in the names of these birds themselves, they have there's a negative connotation to it. So I'm just going to make sure I read the words correctly to you. Let me open it up here. You find it's a very common thing you find throughout the Gemara and Midrashim that when something is, one word is used in a negative context in the Torah, so rabbis will then extrapolate on that, you know, and explain the negative connotation of that word. Well, this eagle. I mean, literally means eagle. That's literally what it means. Nesher is an eagle.
But this is especially unpleasant to hear this because that's the symbol of the United States of America, which is we find good traits in.
It's not to say that an eagle is only bad. Yeah, it's still not kosher.
There's something admirable, that's correct.
Right. But remember that originally they talked about making the turkey the bird of America instead of the eagle.
Right.
And they chose the eagle instead.
So the second
warrior cast. Go
ahead. Yeah, the second bird is called a peres, is the way it's pronounced in Torah, a peres. And the translation given for that, I can't even say it, is asifrage? Anyone know this? Asifrage. Anyone hear of that bird? No. Okay, well, we can look it up.
There is a present.
Asifrage.
You got an internet over there?
It's the parrots or something, you said?
Peres. So the word peres in Hebrew, pras, means like a payment, a reward. And this is an allusion to the Mishnah of Pirkei Avos. It says that one should not serve God for the sake of the reward. So use that word peres. Use that word. Amanas lekabel pras. You shouldn't serve God for the sake of receiving reward. You should serve God because it's the right thing to do. That's how we should serve God. So this bird, the peres, is representative of somebody who serves God for the sake of the reward. And again, it's the same letters used, peres. The words used for reward in that Mishnah is the word pras. And the bird is called a peres. The same three letters, pe, resh, samech. So that's the negative meaning of the word peres. Our job is to serve God out of love, out of a sense of duty of doing what's right, out of a sense of goodness in the world, a sense of gratitude towards God because He's bestowed upon us such a beautiful world and given us life, not for the sake of the reward. The reward will come, but that shouldn't be our main goal. So that's always an ideal in Judaism. Now obviously, serving God for the reward is also okay, and that's definitely a step in the right direction. But the ideal is always to serve God because it's the right thing to do, and because I love God and admire God and acknowledge God.
But we don't have an exact bird. You're just saying an ossifrage or whatever.
Well, that's the translation given by Robert Kaplan for this word. The word in Hebrew is peres, and the word which is in English is ossifrage, whatever an ossifrage is. Okay. Everyone can look it up later. You can Google it or something, see what ossifrage is. If you actually look in the Living Torah, it has pictures of all the birds. You look in that translation of the Chumash, he actually has pictures of each one of these birds. So there's a picture of an ossifrage in there. I said what it is. The third bird mentioned is the Osnia. Osnia in English is translated as an osprey, O-S-P-R-E-Y, which I have heard of before, an osprey. And the word in Hebrew, Osnia, so the word Oz has to do with might or strength. And Ni is always the possessive, it's mine. You know, Ani is me, I, and things which are Ni are things that are mine. So it's representative and symbolic of someone who says that all the might is my own, it's from me. You're not acknowledging God. So Torah describes how a person should never fall into the trap of saying that everything that I've accomplished in life is kolchi v'otzem yadi. It's my own strength and my own power that's gotten me here. We have to always acknowledge that there's a source to it all, which is God. The word ozni, is that the strength belongs to me, and that's the negative connotation of the word ozniya, the aspri. The next two birds mentioned are the Aya and Daya in Hebrew. Aya and Daya. And Da'a and Aya. Say the words right. Da'a and Aya. The Da'a is translated as a kite, and the Aya is a vulture, according to Ryori Kaplan. So a kite and a vulture. And the connotation of those words in Hebrew is Aya and Daya is questioning. Aya is where? Where is it? Daya, Aya Daya would be like, you know, where is my reward? And where it's a question of where's my reward? Where is God? That type of question. So it's one who is denying. The way this book describes it, it's one who's denying reward and punishment. Someone's saying, okay, God, where's the punishment? Where's the reward? Where is it all? I don't see it here. So someone who denies the fundamental of Judaism, which is reward and punishment, that God rewards and God punishes. And denying that's denying a fundamental truth of the Torah. So these two, the birds together, the ayah, where, and daya, you know, where's the reward? Where's the reward? So that is somebody who's going to exclaim, I don't see God's providence in life. I don't see how God rewards and punishes. And that's the negative connotation of that one. Orev is the next one. Orev is a raven, typically is a translation of a raven. We find that same word in the Parshas Noach. He sends the raven out to check if the flood has ended. That's a raven. A raven's not kosher. And the word Orev in Hebrew means comfort or pleasure. And by ingesting an Orev, eating an Orev, so we're making a statement that we're living life to seek comfort and pleasure. And really our ideal is not, we're not living life to seek comfort and pleasure, we're living life to serve God. Comfort and pleasure come alongside of that. And might be necessary, necessary parts of life in order to do what's right, in order to proceed, in order to feel healthy. But we should never think that comfort and pleasure is our goal.
It's a spiritual thing.
Okay, true. That's true. But that's what Ori represents. The next bird mentioned is a Bas Hayana, and which is translated as an ostrich. Bas Hayana is an ostrich. Now the rabbis, I didn't look up the modern science in terms of this, but the rabbis describe it this way. It's described Tanakh this way in the book of Eicha, Lamentations, that an ostrich is cruel to its children. Ostrich is cruel to its children. It has traits of cruelty in an ostrich. Anyone know any science behind that? I don't know. I didn't look it up scientifically, what the examples are exactly, but it's a common metaphor used throughout the Torah and throughout the works of the rabbis. The ostrich has a trait of cruelty. Hmm. So therefore, eating an ostrich would be taking in the trait of cruelty, which is a negative thing.
I only thought of ostriches sticking their head in the ground.
Right.
What's
the word for that? Hebrew? Bas Hayana. It's two words. Bas Hayana. Next we have a tachmas in Hebrew, which has the same letters as the word chamas. Chamas is translated as a form of theft, taking from others. That's one of the reasons given in Parshas Noach why the flood came, is because the land was filled with chamas. So you have the Arab organization of chamas, which I don't know in terms of the Arabic how the words relate. It is related in Arabic somehow, I'm not really sure. But the word in Hebrew chamas refers to theft, taking other people's belongings. That's chamas. And the flood came in Parshas Noach because the land was filled with chamas, the Torah says. So that's and tachmas, the English translation, is an owl. Owl, yeah. So it's chamas. The owl is, yeah, it's tachmas. Next we have shachaf. And that's translated as a gull. So the shachaf is a gull. The gull is not kosher. And the word shachaf in Hebrew can also mean something bent over. So they say that's an allusion to the snake, because the snake's punishment was you're going to slither on the ground. Then he stood on his hind legs, and then God said he's to slither on the ground. You have to crawl on your belly. So therefore, the trait of shachaf, which we're saying is a gull, it alludes to the evil of the snake being bent over and slithering on the ground. So that's a shachaf. And again, it's not necessarily that the actual physical bird has this negative trait within it, but it means that there's some deeper spiritual influence on this bird which may affect the person. Next is the, maybe read it right, is hanetz, the netz. Netz is translated as a hawk. Netz is a hawk. And the word netz is related to the word nietz, which is to anger or to insult. It says, "Botzea birach nietz Hashem." One who has stolen bread and makes a blessing has angered Hashem. It's a verse in the Torah. So nietz, the hawk, is nietz. It has the connotation of anger or insult. So obviously, that's not a good thing to take into your system. Anger and insult is obviously a negative trait, and we want to avoid that. Next, the kos is the next one, which is translated as a falcon. And a kos also means a cup, which is an allusion to drinking. And as we know, you know, excessive drinking is a negative thing, and people lose control. Very clear throughout the Torah, throughout the books of the rabbis, that you know, drinking in limitation can be a very positive thing. Drinking in excess is a terrible thing. So we're saying the kos has a connotation, the falcon has a connotation of drinking.
Except from certain holidays.
Some certain holidays, but that's a different discussion. The next one is called a... Make sure I pronounce it right. Shalach. Shalach. And I don't know that in English. I don't know what this bird is. It's called a cormorant. You know, cormorants. Heard of cormorants? Yeah.
Okay. It's not kosher.
A cormorant, and the term shalach has to do also with casting aside. Shalach is to cast off something, and the work I was looking at describes how it relates to the verse. In the prophets, it says, "Osi hishlachta acharei gevecha." You've tossed me, you've cast me aside, in place of or beside your body. But you focused more on your physical body and cast God aside. That's what that verse means.
The word shalach, is that the same word as the sen?
That's a different letter. The sen has a ches at the end. This is a chaf at the end. So to put our body before our spiritual needs, that's described as casting off God for our body, is the verse quoted in the prophets, and therefore that's the negative connotation of the cormorant, the shalach. There then comes the tinshames, which is translated as a... right there. So I can't read my writing anymore. Let's see. It looks like swan, but I don't think that's right. I'll have to look that up again, because I wrote it to mess. I can't read my writing. I probably wrote it very fast. So, that's a Tin Shemes. I'm trying to think in my mind what Tin Shemes is translated as. I can't remember. A Tin Shemes. So we'll look that one up. But a Tin Shemes is the name of the same letters as Tain Shamta, which means excommunication. Shamta in Aramaic is excommunication. The Gemara used that term to excommunicate somebody. So obviously, you know, that's a negative thing, excommunication. We don't want that to come and get into our system. The next bird is a ka'as, which is translated as a pelican. And the word ka'as in Hebrew also can mean disgust or even to vomit. So ka'as. Lahaki is to spit out, to vomit, to be disgusted by something. So therefore, obviously, again, that's a negative connotation. To bring that into our system would be a negative thing. The next one is a very fascinating bird. It's called the racham. A racham is translated as a magpie. You know what a magpie is? Magpie. Did you say it, magpie? I've seen a magpie before. Okay. Magpie. So racham is a magpie. So the term racham is the same letter as the word rechem, which can mean a womb. Womb. So, right, it could mean compassion. But the fact that the Torah says this bird is impure, we're going to look for the negative meaning of the word that we said before. And the word womb can also have a connotation of immorality, of sexual propriety. So that's racham. That's magpie. And then the final one mentioned is the chasida, which is a stork. Now, it's a fascinating thing, because chasida also, the word in there is chesed, which is kindness, which seems to be a very good trait. So there's two different explanations of what's negative about the stork. So number one, the word chasida, besides meaning kindness, actually has different meaning. It can also mean, it's a terminology of embarrassment or shame. It's actually used in that way as well. The Gemara uses that term all the time to mean shame or embarrassment. So in its negative context, chasida means embarrassment or shame. Obviously, that's a terrible thing. Also, it can refer to what's called a chasid shota, which is you have a concept that's actually discussed in Mishnayos, and I'm sure we've all encountered it at some point, where somebody is acting righteous, but doing something really stupid. Meaning that the Gemara's example is, let's say there's somebody who walks by a woman who's drowning. He says, I can't look at women. I'm too pious to look at women. It doesn't save her. So that's called a chassid shota. That's what we call it, a righteous person who's crazy. He's insane. That's wrong. So chassida, even though you have a positive connotation of chassid, which is to be pious, but in the impure form, so then piety could be a terrible thing if you're doing it in a place where it's not needed. So the halacha, obviously, is you're going to save the person's life. That's clear in the Torah, that, you know, pick her up, take her out, even if she's not wearing clothing, take her out, whatever it is, you know. But so someone walks by the woman and says, I can't look at you because I'm too pious. That's a chassid shota, crazy chassid. Someone is a crazy righteous person. So that's one example. The other interesting point, which is mentioned in other sources, is that if you look at the way Rashi describes this term, the chassida, which again were translated as a stork. Again, translations, things get lost in translation. None of these are 100% necessarily accurate. It says, Rashi says, why is she called a chassida? Why is the bird called a kind bird? Because, osa chassidus im chavrosea bimazonos. Because she does kindness with her friends by giving her friends food. So this type of bird will feed its other birds, will also feed other birds food. So the question always is, well then, why is it a non-kosher bird? That seems to be a very nice trait, to help others feed them food. Why is this bird not kosher? So the answer which is given, I forgot who says this answer, but it's a very interesting answer. It says, if you read Rashi carefully, it says she only does kindness with her friends. She ignores everyone else. With her friends she does kindness. So it's a very important lesson to us that kindness has to reach, you know, beyond our own circles. The kindness isn't just for myself, my family, my friends. Kindness is for those who are in need. And if there are people who are in need, who are beyond my circle, so then I have to do kindness to them as well. This bird only is kind to her friends, not to anyone else. So that's the negative trait of kindness within this bird. So that's another lesson you find from this chassida, which again is translated as a stork.
It's similar. It seems like the ones with the long legs and the egret and probably that other one.
Yeah.
They stand on one leg, a lot of them, and they're tall.
Yeah,
birds.
Right. There are similarities, and we said even physically there are some signs to an unkosher or kosher bird. Okay. I mentioned last week in terms of the extra finger. It's called, is it talon? You said it's called.
A talon.
Yeah, talon. Right. There's a talon on a kosher bird. There has a certain extra stomach on a kosher bird. So there are different signs of kosher and unkosher. Birds of prey are never kosher. Three more birds mentioned. Next bird is anafa. Anafa is translated as a heron, which I do see around here. They're very beautiful birds. But the word anafa could also mean anger in Hebrew. And obviously anger is a negative trait. So that's the implication of the word anafa. There is a bird called duchifas, which is translated as a hoopy. Ever hear that? A hoopy?
Hoopy?
Or did I write that?
Like a whooping crane.
Not a whooping crane. this is Rabbi Kaplan. I think I wrote a hoopy here. Yeah, I wrote this down fast. So I'm a little messy in my head writing. I think
the word
is
H
O O P.
They have whooping
crane. I E. Hoopy. Hoopo? Hoopo?
Hoopy.
Hoopy. We'll look that one up too. Hoopy. So, could be I wrote it down wrong also. But so the word in Hebrew is duchifas. Which could also mean the word du can refer to somebody's ego, and the word chifas can refer to binding down something. So this bird is a bird which has a crown on it, it's described. So it kind of looks like it's an arrogant bird walking around with this crown. And our job is to make sure that we don't let our arrogance take over us. So that's the idea of du chifas. We can look up what the bird actually is. I think I wrote hoopy down, so I'll look that up again.
Hoopy is, that's what art scroll says.
You've seen the art scroll. It says hoopy. Okay, so it is a hoopy. I was right. It's a bird that has some sort of crown on its head. That's how it looks. It looks like it's an arrogant bird. And finally, the atalef. Atalef is a bat. I believe that's the modern Hebrew word as well for a bat, atalef. A bat is a nocturnal bird, which, you know, we would say it doesn't see the light. You know, it's only in the darkness. The darkness has a negative connotation, and light is a positive connotation. The Torah is compared to light, evil is compared to darkness. So a bird which only stays in the darkness and doesn't see the light is considered, and it has a negative connotation to it as well. So those are the different ramazim, the different implications and hints to negative traits within the Hebrew names of these non-kosher birds. Yeah, right. So that type of thing.
Yeah.
I guess the hoopy must have a bigger crown or nicer crown.
But the rooster, is a rooster kosher?
A rooster is kosher. Yeah.
Right.
So again, these are not the only reason, and we can't, you know, we can't necessarily extrapolate from this onwards. That's for sure. The Gemara does say that if you want to stop a rooster from reproducing, you remove its crown, the Gemara says. And the Gemara says, does that create a physical effect on the rooster? The Gemara says, no, but he loses his self-confidence, as the Gemara says. Which is just a good lesson for us also. But at that point, he loses his self-confidence, and he loses his crown. So therefore, he won't reproduce anymore. I guess he's too shy to go talk to the hens. I don't know. But, so that's those are the names of all the non-kosher birds. Now, when it comes to the locusts, the Torah actually lists the names of the kosher locusts. When it comes to the birds, it lists the names of the non-kosher birds, implying the rest of them are kosher. When it comes to the locusts, it lists the names of the kosher locusts, implying all the rest of them are not kosher. So as we're discussing names, let's talk about locusts for a second. This, the review from last week, the signs of a kosher locust, not that any of us are going to buy any locusts today, as far as I know, but the signs of a kosher locust, it's called in Hebrew, it has raglav with karsulim, which means that it has legs, it has beyond its four legs, it has an extra set of jumping legs. I don't know, I'm sure there's a scientific term to it, but it has an extra set of jumping legs. And then also has four wings that cover the entire body, or at least most of the body. Those are signs of a kosher locust. So legs, one lesson you find behind the legs of a locust are that it needs to have both, its four legs on the ground plus the extra jumping legs. So the lesson to us would be that as humans, we're human beings, we have to be firmly grounded in this world. God put us in this world for a reason. He didn't mean for us to live out of this world. I mean, Judaism very much believes in enjoying food, marriage, having children. These are very Jewish beliefs. Not to avoid this world, but to harness this world and use it for spirituality. But yet, the jumping legs present to us, don't get stuck to the lower world. Make sure that you're able to ascend and elevate yourself beyond this world. So we have to have our feet firmly planted on the ground in this world, but yet we want to have our jumping legs so we can actually jump beyond this world. And that's the soul of the person is supposed to help to elevate ourselves beyond the world and not stick us down to the ground. That's our idea. So the idea of kra'ayim, which are these jumping legs, is that concept of elevating our lives beyond the physical world. So that's always the balance of a Jew. We're supposed to live within the world and live physical lives. And mitzvahs are very physical things. We sit down, we eat a Shabbos meal, we eat our matzah. We take a lulav, which is it's a branch. These are all very physical things, but yet we're supposed to elevate them to another level. So we have our feet firmly planted on the ground, but yet we're jumping for the heights. The other connotation, it says that they have to have kra'ayim, which also has to do with these jumping legs. And the word kra'ayim in Hebrew could also mean to bend down or to bow. Kilcha tichra kol berach, all knees will bow to you. And the idea also is it's an allusion to submitting to God, that we will bow down to God, and that's the idea of kra'ayim. So that's another sign for a kosher locust. You have the wings, you have the jumping legs, and you have the other legs. So that's the wings, obviously, we talked about the wings being clothing. The wings obviously take you higher, that's the wings do, which is a positive thing. The jumping legs elevate you. The other legs on the ground keep you firmly planted in this world. And the connotation of the word kra'ayim for these jumping legs is a connotation of submission to God, of bending down and bowing down to God. The names of the kosher locusts, the first one, I didn't translate them because if you look up the translations, it basically says, black locust, red locust, blue locust, green locust. There's not really, I don't know if there's like a species name for these types of locusts. So I'll tell you the Hebrew terms. The Hebrew term for one type of kosher locust is called arbe. And the word arbe, and again, now we're in the context of kosher. So obviously these will have positive connotations because these are kosher animals. So therefore, arbe has to do with ribuy, with abundance, a lot. And obviously we're referring to in the world of good and of kosher, abundance of mitzvos, abundance of goodness, abundance of kindness, abundance of Torah study. That's the abundance we're talking about. The next word, the next kosher locus is called a sal'am. Which has the same letters as the word Selah. So Selah literally means a rock. And we often refer to God as Hashem Sal'i. Hashem is our rock. He's our boulder. If you look through the translation of Tefillah, many points of Tefillah, we refer to God as the rock, our redeemer. He's our rock. Because God is our solid foundation in this world. God's always there for us. It alludes to the concept of trusting God, of bitachon, of always, that God is always there as our strong point, as our focus in this world. So he's like a rock, immutable. So that's the connotation of the word sal'am. The next type of kosher locust is referred to as a chargol. Chargol. A chargol alludes to a pasuk a verse in Tehillim, in Psalms, and that verse says, Galgel al Hashem tzarchecha betach alav, that you should roll onto God all of your needs and trust in God. So the idea of a goal, like the word har goal, goal is to roll your needs onto God, which means that we have to take all of our burdens in life and place them into God's hands. And that's the concept of trusting in God. And finally, a very interesting one, the last kosher locust mentioned is called a chagav. A chagav is the numerical value, the gematria of the word chagav. The first letter is ches, is 8. The middle letter is gimel, which is 3. The last letter is a bez, which is 2. That equals 13. And the number 13 is a significant number in Judaism. You find 13 used in a lot of places. There's 13 attributes of kindness of God. There's always saying Yom Kippur over and over again. In Elo, we're asking for God's mercy. There are 13 methods used to expound upon the Torah, which are some people do say in the beginning of davening in the morning. There's the Yudgim Ominos Rabbi Yishmael, the 13 different ways Rabbi Yishmael taught us how to extrapolate from the Torah. There's actually, if you split up the tribe of Joseph into his two sons, the Torah does commonly, there's 13 tribes. We usually say 12 tribes, because we usually count Joseph as one. The Torah commonly will refer to as Ephraim and Manasseh separately, end up with 13. Other examples of 13, but the other 13 is used throughout the Torah. So Bar Mitzvah is obviously 13. But what's the significance of 13? So 13 is, the word for one, Echad, also has the gematria of 13. And we say God is one, Hashem Echad, Shema. So Aleph, Ches, Dalet. Aleph is 1, Ches is 8, Dalet is 4, that equals 13. And the concept of 13 is that we believe that God is one, the unity of God, there's nothing else besides God, that's God is one. 13 is a number we view as the expansion of one into many different parts. So what I mean by that is, let's do the metaphor of a puzzle. So you have a jigsaw puzzle, you break up a lot of different pieces, put it all together, so it's one, but yet it's many pieces as well. So if you look, so there's the idea of something being one. So if you have just a picture, that's just one picture. You make a jigsaw puzzle out of it, put pieces together, so it's also one, but it's many. But it's many turning into one. That's the idea of 13. The 13 symbolically represents that. Now the Maharal, he's a commentary who discusses very much the significance of numbers. He tries to show even physically how 13 implies that. So he says, if I remember correctly, if you take a cube, three-dimensional cube, so it has actually, it'll have 14, it'll have 12, 12 sides, 12 lines, or 12 edges, it's called, 12 edges on a cube. So that's the expansion outwards, and then there's going to be one midpoint that's all gathering around. That's the 13th point. That's how the Maharal describes it. So 13 is that one midpoint where everything will gather around and join all together as one. So your cube's going to have 12 edges, and then you're going to have that one midpoint, which is the focal point of the entire cube. So that's why it is. But be it as it may, the word Echad, its gematria, its numerical value is 13, which means 13 has the significance of making things back into one again. So the Chagav, which is this type of locust, its gematria as well is 13, which represents the unity of God once again. Now the world, God is one, the world has lots of different pieces, but they all lead back to God once again. That's the significance of 13. Numbers are always a fascinating discussion, which they can have their own separate talk, numbers. But those are the four different kosher types of locusts. The Arbes, the Salam, the Chargol, and the Chagav. Any questions on any of these species before we move on? Oh wow, it's late already. Okay, never mind. Maybe we'll stop today. I don't know how late it got. Right, so I guess we'll stop here, and next week we'll move onwards next week. Is there a reason not?
Thanksgiving.
It's Tuesday. Is everyone going to be around next week? People going out of town? Okay, I'll leave next week.